stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. A possible eighth suspect in Paris shootings. French police Sunday questioned close relatives of Omar Ismail Mostafavi, the first terrorist identified in the Friday night attack on Paris that killed at least 129 people, and they were searching for a possible eighth suspect who may have gotten away. Mostafavi's father, brother, and sister-in-law were among six people the authorities detained as France observed the first of 3 days of national mourning in the aftermath of the carnage that has shocked the world. Eric Prudol is a neighbor of Houari Mostafavi, the brother of the reported suicide bomber. He told French media that the Mostafavis are very polite and nice, sociable, nothing to say. They have a one-year-old girl, and they asked us to say if she was too loud. They were afraid to make a lot of noise. No. And they were extremely generous. Mostafavi was one of seven attackers, all of them wearing suicide vests packed with explosives, who died during the simultaneous attacks, with six of them blowing themselves up and the seventh killed in a shootout with police. At least three of the seven were French nationals. President Obama has vowed to help France in hunting down the perpetrators of Friday's Paris attacks and said he plans to redouble efforts to eliminate the Islamic State group known in Arabic as Daesh. The U.S. leader spoke on Sunday after meeting with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan at the start of the G20 summit in this Turkish Mediterranean resort.
As was true with the terrible attacks that took place in Ankara, the killing of innocent people based on a twisted ideology is an attack not just on France, not just on Turkey, but it's an attack on the civilized world.
This is VOA News. Egyptian police say the bodies of 15 African migrants were found shot dead in Egypt's Sinai Peninsula near the country's border with Israel. Another eight migrants were also found wounded in the attack. Officials say the migrants were found early Sunday morning south of the town of Rafah. It was not clear who had attacked the migrants or where they originated from. The Sinai Peninsula is a major route for African migrants trying to reach Israel. The U.S. Defense Department says an American airstrike has killed the head of the Islamic State group in Libya. Abu Nabil was an Iraqi national and an al-Qaeda operative. A Pentagon spokesman said the operation against Nabil was authorized and initiated prior to Friday night's terrorist attacks in Paris. World powers have made headway on a plan for a political transition in Syria. However, the Paris terrorist attacks overshadowed their talks in Vienna on Saturday. VOA's Pam Dawkins has the story.
Members of the International Syria Support Group said the deadly attacks in Paris and the Islamic State's claim of responsibility had strengthened their resolve to find a political resolution to Syria's crisis. Negotiators agreed to try to bring Syrian government and opposition representatives into UN-mediated talks by January. They also set a timeline for a plan that could lead to free and fair elections. But old disagreements festered, such as the status of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. But some say even if negotiators reach a final agreement, getting buy-in from the Syrian people could be difficult. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, Vienna.
For more on this story, visit our website at voanews.com. A report Sunday from South Korea's Yonhap News Agency says North Korea has declared a no-navigation zone off its eastern coast, a sign it may be preparing to test launch a missile. The zone is in effect from November 11th to December 7th, according to an unnamed government source quoted by Yonhap. Another anonymous government source says it is possible that the North could be preparing to test a submarine-launched ballistic missile. North Korea has issued previous no-navigation zones in the East Sea without launching a missile. The country's in under numerous UN-led sanctions for conducting previous ballistic missile and nuclear tests. Myanmar President Thein Sein is promising a smooth transition to a new government in an attempt to remove fears the military will once again ignore the results of a free election. Thein Sein made the promise during a meeting with several political parties in Yangon on Sunday, 1 week after a historic election won by opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy Party in a stunning landslide. This is Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington.
About corruption that involves government is that it revolves around procurement, and procurement is between government, who is procuring services.
The Kenyan government partners with the private sector to fight against corruption.
The postponement came as a request from the government of South Sudan that said in order for it to be able to prepare for that summit.
IGAD postpones the Heads of State Summit aim to review the implementation of South Sudan's peace accord.
At last, Somalia is facing the problems of a country coming together rather than falling apart.
And a top UN envoy says Somalia is well advanced in its transformation from a failed state to a recovering nation. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. An anti-corruption group established by the Kenyan government and the private sector is expected to present a report about strategies to combat corruption to President Uhuru Kenyatta. This following concerns of endemic corruption in public institutions. Mr. Kenyatta recently acknowledged the challenge his administration faces to weed out graft after investors said corruption is a major challenge to doing business in the East African country. Presidential spokesman Manoah Esipisu told me Kenyatta is committed to weeding out corruption, especially in the procurement processes.
Well, the thing about corruption that involves government is that it revolves around procurement, and procurement is between government, who is procuring services, and the private sector, which is supplying those services. So the president and the private sector alliance, which is the umbrella group that includes all private sector organizations in Kenya, put together this group, essentially, involving the executive and the private sector in order to deal with the issues around procurement, perceived or real corruption.
So when will this body begin its work?
It's already begun its work. It has to report back within a week with tangible recommendations on how to move forward in dealing with specifically the area of procurement, which the Ethics and Anti-Corruption Commission says accounts for 70% of all corruption in Kenya.
Some Kenyans have expressed concern about what they call endemic or perceived corruption in public institutions and all that. How committed is the president to resolving this problem?
The president has always been committed. That is not in question at all. He's taken so many actions in that direction in the recent past. This is yet another of those actions he is taking. It's quite acknowledged that the president has been on this for a bit. Fighting corruption is one of his major campaign issues. I think that, yes, people are concerned, as he is, about some of the cases that we're hearing about. But the principal point is that Kenya is a vibrant democracy with a free press. A lot of the cases we're hearing now, you wouldn't have heard about them 10 years ago because you had no access. So pretty much the president has fought for this greater openness, which is why we are hearing more of these things coming out. But it does not reflect the fact that we are not we're not fighting as hard as we should. The point is, we are fighting as hard as we can. We are greatly committed to this, and I think we will continue to do so.
Last time when President Obama was in the country, he talked about cooperating with your government to help address some of these challenges with regards to corruption. Is there any cooperation with international partners to resolve this challenge?
Of course, we continue to partner with the U.S. government, with the European Union, with others in Europe. Obviously, we would like to see greater participation, especially where money stolen from Kenya have been used to buy property abroad. So we would like to see some of that, the proceeds of illicit financing, for instance, come back to Kenya. That's the type of thing we would like to see. And we continue to commit to partnering with similar-minded governments in fighting corruption, fighting illicit financing, and fighting other illegalities that may happen within our shores and outside of them.
With this latest move, with regards to the cooperation between the government and the private sector, what message does the government want to pass to the people of Kenya about its seriousness towards fighting graft?
Fighting graft is not about the government. As I just said, procurement is about government as procurers and the private sector as the suppliers. We have all of us to be dedicated to fighting it if we are to succeed. And therefore, we would like to see the private sector pulling its weight in the fight against corruption as much as it expects the government to pull its weight in this fight.
What is your message to the people of Kenya concerning this?
That we will go the full hog in this fight. No one is looking behind. And we are determined to get this problem resolved.
Manoah Esipisu is the spokesman for the Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. He spoke with me from the capital, Nairobi. The Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, has postponed the Heads of State Summit scheduled to be held in the South Sudanese capital, Juba. High on the agenda was the review of the implementation of the peace agreement signed between President Salva Kiir and leader of the rebel movement, Dr. Riek Machar. Attorney Wek Attorney spokesman for President Kiir told me that the administration asked for the postponement to allow for the government in Juba to adequately prepare for the summit.
The postponements came as a request from the government of South Sudan that said in order for it to be able to prepare for that summit and the reception later on of the advance team of the rebels, then it has to, you know, to be postponed until the 26th of this month.
Why did the government ask for a postponement, knowing very well that it had ample time to prepare for this meeting and part of the process to ensure the implementation of the peace accord to restore peace and stability to South Sudan?
The government is on the right track because the 90 days, which was actually given by the agreement as a pre-interim to start, will elapse on the 26th of August. So the government was asking within the framework of the agreement itself.
But the government initially announced that Dr. Riek Machar was supposed to be in Juba coming this week. Why that? Because the rebels came out saying that it is not true, that information has not been communicated to Dr. Riek Machar. Is there a breakdown in communication between Juba and the rebels?
No, the rebels and Juba are not communicating directly. We have the mediators that are the IGAD Plus. And the IGAD Plus were the one we informed in Juba about the summit to be held in Juba on the 19th. And we were also told that, the Ethiopian Prime Minister Desalegn will be accompanied by Riek Machar. This is what we got. So we thought by the IGAD telling us that, we thought they might have also made the rebel aware. Because we don't have the communication between us except through the mediators, and therefore we were informed by the mediators. If they are not informed, then it is not our problems.
What is the process so far about the implementation of the peace accord recently signed in Addis Ababa? How is the progress so far?
The progress is very clear. As government, we have already embarked on the process of implementing the agreement, and we are very clear on that. We have already started, to earmark places for our troops to be allocated when they withdraw from Juba. As a part of demilitarization of the city, we have done that already. And we have signed, even before the rebels, we've signed the the security arrangement, which the rebel has recently actually initialed. And we have started even to tell, you know, to tell them that we will be able to we will be ready to receive them from the 26th.
Now, the humanitarian agencies are still expressing concern that some of their aid workers are unable to go to these places to provide much-needed aid to citizens because of what they describe as sporadic fighting. Why is this still going on since the process of implementing this peace accord is ongoing?
I don't think the humanitarian workers were talking about the government control areas. All the government control areas are accessible to humanitarian organizations, and anything within the government control areas is as secure as, you know, as any other place that you think is secure in the world. So the only problem is that the rebels areas are, there are some rebels that are still, you know, attacking the government forces. And the government sometimes does not guarantee the humanitarian aid that, that goes through, you know, rebel control areas, you know, because of the lack of confidence, you know, lack of trust on the rebel. The rebel might attack like what happened when the barrage that was owned by UNMISS was offloaded by the rebel, you know, and it was carrying guns. So these are some precautions that the government make here and there, but all the government control areas are secure and humanitarian access is allowed.
Attorney Wek Attorney is the spokesman for the South Sudanese President Salva Kiir. He spoke with me from Berlin, Germany. As Ugandans prepare for next year's general election, Parliament has maintained the representation of all special interest groups. The special interest groups include people with disabilities, youth, the army, and workers. However, a number of lawmakers across the political divide demanded that the representation of the army in Parliament be revised to bar the officers from partisan politics. Wilfred Niwagaba is a member of Parliament. Reporter Douglas Impuga reached him in the Ugandan capital, Kampala, for his perspective.
My strong view is that as Parliament, we've abdicated responsibility by not involving the population to hear their views on that particular matter.
Among the special interest groups that Parliament decided to keep in the Parliament, are the army. What's your view of the, having army representatives in a multi-party democracy?
Of course, the army's presence in the parliament in a multi-party democracy doesn't agar well. Because, in effect, you are making the army partisan. Shouldn't be a position.
What's the general view of parliament having to review election laws during campaign season?
We are dealing with a very clear situation. Bringing resurrected elections when nominations have even begun, when people have already picked forms. It's a very clear situation. But of course, like in respect of Kampala Capital City Authority, the government is targeting an individual called Lukwago. And I'm wondering why government should continue to bring rules to target individuals.
And what do you think is the way forward? Because I'm told the Electoral Commission is working on the assumption that Parliament will change laws to fit, to suit whatever the government wants to do. And they have halted, I'm told, the nomination of the Kampala mayor.
Yeah, you know, Achigunu's commission has been roundly exposed as acting on the instincts of President Yoweri Museveni. It was so strange for an entire commission to suspend the nomination in anticipation of what Parliament may or may not do.
Given all that, how should people take the integrity of that commission?
As Colonel Caesar Lessing rightly says, it is Museveni's walking stick. Because it is now clear for everybody to see that this is a commission that only acts on what President Museveni wants.
So is there a possibility of a free and fair elections in that case?
When you have this kind of electoral commission, it is still a dream. You have the electoral rolls that are tilted in favor of one side. You have the commission that roundly acts one on behalf of an individual, not the population. what the general strategists have said, what they have said. I have even read in today's paper, Chigundu says, no, this commission is not the one of 2006, meaning that he also concedes that in the 2006 the commission did something else.
Wilfred Niwagaba is a Ugandan member of parliament. He spoke with reporter Douglas Impuga from Kampala. The outgoing United States ambassador to Zimbabwe, Bruce Wharton, says though relations between Harare and Washington have thawed, not enough has been done by Harare to warrant America to lift the so-called targeted sanctions. The sanctions were imposed in 2003 against President Robert Mugabe and members of his inner circle for human rights abuses, poor rigging, among other ills. For VOA, Ivan Chafera has more.
Speaking at a breakfast meeting with journalists, Wharton said while the situation in Zimbabwe has improved, not enough has been done to warrant the removal of the so-called targeted sanctions on President Robert Mugabe and members of his inner circle. He said Harare continues to ignore court decisions, violate people's rights, and has not compensated white commercial farmers whose land was expropriated more than a decade ago by the government.
The implementation of the indigenization law has remained hard to predict, and it seems to change from time to time. And that has a chilling effect on an investor's willingness to put money into a country.
Wharton said the targeted sanctions, which affect 106 individuals and more than 60 companies in Zimbabwe, were not really an issue, adding a lot depends on the country's policies.
Sanctions are not the central issue here. The central issue are the policies enacted by the government of Zimbabwe, whether it's land reform or the way the law is enforced or tolerance for political violence. Those are the things that have driven this economy up or down. And sanctions are sort of a sideshow.
The outgoing ambassador said the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act, ZIDERA, under which the sanctions were imposed, clearly spells out what Zimbabwe must do to have them lifted. But he said the U.S. president could use his discretion to scrap the measures if the situation improves. ZIDERA said Wharton also provides for American support of Zimbabwe's debt relief efforts, adding his country has done so by supporting the International Monetary Fund Staff Monitored Program and Zimbabwe's debt relief plans with the International Monetary Fund.
First of all, that we have supported the IMF Staff Monitor Program here. Publicly and privately, we've supported that. And secondly, at the big meeting in Lima last month, we didn't bang our shoe against the podium and say no, no, 1,000 times no. We were supportive of that as well.
Wharton said Zimbabwe could boost agricultural production and revive its economy by giving title to landholders. He said clarity on the country's indigenization laws is critical as this would help attract investment to the country. Also key in lowering foreign investors is political stability, Wharton said. He said the U.S. did not support political parties in Zimbabwe, but supports processes and principles of democratic elections. Wharton, who leaves Zimbabwe after a three-year tour of duty, said he had done a lot to improve relations between Harare and Washington, adding the number of people on targeted sanctions had gone down by 25 during his tour of duty.
I've also been able to achieve high-level meetings between both government of Zimbabwe and U.S. government officials and between private Zimbabweans, that is, business people particularly, and high-level Americans. So I feel like there's progress there. I think Washington has a deeper, more nuanced understanding of this nation.
He said Zimbabwe is a bright future, adding its economy could grow by 10% annually in the near future with the right policies in place. He described President Robert Mugabe as a lion of Africa, a leader who had liberated his people and fought apartheid through the frontline states, now the Southern African Development Community.
Robert Mugabe is a lion of Africa. He has dedicated his life to creating a free and independent Zimbabwe. He's one of the leaders not only of Zimbabwe's liberation movement, but of the frontline states, helped bring down apartheid in South Africa.
From Harare, this is Ivan Chifera.
Angie Imanishimwe is a conservationist with the Rwanda National Park Service. He came to the United States as a Washington Mandela Fellow of the Youth African Leadership Initiative. He talks about the community-based anti-poaching work he has done in Rwanda. Viewer's Philip Alexio has more.
Angie Imanishimwe is passionate about nature. He's not just a tour guide at a national park back home in Rwanda, but he came up with a plan to save the environment from poachers who were destroying his beloved ecosystem.
I developed the approach of what I can call win-win situation. I said, let me put in place a community-based organization which can engage the community in biodiversity conservation, but also which can provide the economic development to the community around the Nyungwe National Park.
Ange was named Rwanda's top young innovator in 2012.
Okay.
With the grant money he won, he created a cooperative, yes, and he educated the poachers and introduced them to a new method of feeding their families and making use of their land. Ange purchased cows and got the poachers involved in a milk collection cooperative and the raising of livestock. He ended up creating 800 jobs.
Now, we gave jobs to the people who were poachers before. Now, what we're doing is to see how we can create more green jobs and make sure that people can be really very healthy.
Ange's love of the environment and his passion to save it is what inspired him to become a young African leader. After studying civic leadership at the University of California at Berkeley, he was able to intern at Boston's Nature Conservancy. Apart from the lecture circuit, Ange's internship has been a hands-on experience with Mother Nature.
We are now on our way to Block Island to see the migratory birds and other animal species.
Block Island is a national wildlife refuge located 19 kilometers off the coast of the state of Rhode Island. Block Island is well known for more than 40 species of wildlife classified as rare and endangered. Moreover, it's a well-known stopover for thousands of migratory birds. Ornithologist Scott Cummings, he explains the frequent flyer pattern of the black and white warblers.
He'll fly 800 miles across the Gulf of Mexico in one flight.
800 miles?
800 miles. He'll leave like 6 o'clock at night, yeah, and he'll arrive at between, yeah, 11 and 1 the next day, yeah, in the morning.
Cummings and his group are licensed by the government to attach stainless steel bands to the migratory birds, known as bird banding, a means of studying the bird's migratory patterns.
And there you go. That's the best part.
A local beekeeper shared his tips on honey production Ange can bring back to Africa.
He's making 40 kilos per hive per year, and he has about 50 beehives, and he's making 2 tons a year. So it is really interesting, and I think it is what African people, we can learn from him. We have potential markets in the Western country.
I think I'm really very happy because what I learned in the U.S. met my expectations, and now I feel a very important person who can go and change the whole continent in terms of economic development.
That was YALI fellow Ange Imanishimwe. He spoke with viewers Philip Alexio about his experience in Rwanda and the United States. Meanwhile, the UN's top diplomat in Somalia, Nicolas Say, says the country is well advanced in its transformation from a failed state to a recovering nation. Kay recently told the UN Security Council that 2016 will be a decisive year for Somalia on several fronts. From the United Nations, viewers Margaret Bashir has more.
In his final briefing to the council after more than 2 years as the UN's envoy in Somalia, Kay said the country is moving away from the chaos that defined it for more than two decades.
At last, Somalia is facing the problems of a country coming together rather than falling apart.
Kay noted work on organizing the country's numerous regions into states is slowly progressing and urged a swift conclusion to that process. Next year's elections will also be an important benchmark. Kay said they must be conducted on time and be more inclusive than 2012's vote. The envoy also noted that no major commercial ship has been seized by pirates off Somalia's coast for more than 3 years. One ongoing spoiler to Somalia's recovery is the Al-Shabaab terrorist group, which continues to attack government and civilian targets, carrying out a deadly bombing on a well-known hotel just over a week ago. Meanwhile, the road for Somalia's recovery is long. Some 3.2 million people still need assistance to survive, and the UN is warning that projected flooding and drought could make the situation worse. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, right here in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sport with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Well, it's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Nigeria and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, November 15th. Gabon has become the first country to reach the group stage of the African qualifying series for the 2018 FIFA World Cup in Russia. Gabon beat Mozambique 4-3 on penalties following extra time in Libreville on Saturday. The match went into extra time after Gabon won 1-0 to level the second round tie at 1-1 on aggregate. A crowd that included President Ali Bongo Ondimba watched the match. After 30 tense on exciting minutes of extra time, Gabon goalkeeper Didier Obono saved two shootout kicks. Earlier on Saturday, Chad shocked Egypt 1-0, and Algeria came from 2 goals down to draw 2-2 with Tanzania in first leg matches of the qualifiers. The Chadians triumphed in N'Djamena 2 months after suffering a 5-1 Africa Cup of Nations drubbing from the Egyptians at the same ground. Tunisia-based captain Ezekiel Ndusse won the match with a flying header past Egypt's goalkeeper Ahmed El Shenawy on 73 minutes. The return match is scheduled for Tuesday in Alexandria. In the Algeria-Tanzania match, Islam Slimani struck twice within 4 minutes midway through the second half for four-time qualifier Algeria, which is 109 places above Tanzania on the world rankings. It was the second dramatic comeback in as many days in East Africa by a highly ranked visiting team, with Senegal coming from 2 goals down to draw 2-2 in Madagascar. In Ethiopia, Congo-Brazzaville won 4-3. It was a goal feast at the Addis Ababa Stadium, where Ethiopia took the lead and then fell 4-1 behind, before scoring twice in the closing stages. And Botswana used home advantage to beat Mali 2-1 in a game that completed the 20 first leg matches in the second round of qualifying for Russia. Here now are the other highlights of the second round first leg matches in the African qualifiers for the 2018 FIFA World Cup. Comoros, pressing home advantage, took the game to Ghana's Black Stars and secured a stunning goalless draw. While Ghana is ranked 30th in the world, Comoros is ranked 177th. Comoros was not the only Indian Ocean island that impressed, as Madagascar took on the 2002 World Cup quarterfinalist Senegal. The Malagasy were leading 2-0 before Senegal realized it needed to up its game. Eventually, the match ended 2-2. Another team that punched above its weight was Botswana. The Southern African country stunned Mali with a 2-1 victory, giving the home side fans plenty to cheer about. Mali is ranked 42 places higher than Botswana. Let us remind our listeners that the 40 teams involved in the second stage are scheduled to complete their first and return leg matches on November 17th. The 20 aggregate winners from the second round will proceed to the third and final qualifying stage, which is the group phase. At this stage, the 20 teams will be divided into 5 groups of 4 teams each. The 5 group winners will qualify to represent Africa at the 2018 FIFA World Cup in Russia. Same with football. Didier Drogba, who plays for Montreal Impact in the Major League Soccer, MLS, has dismissed suggestions that spending time in London during the MLS break will pave the way for another return to English Premiership club Chelsea. The 37-year-old striker moved to the MLS after his second spell at the Stamford Bridge Club. But while Drogba was open to the idea of training with Chelsea to maintain his fitness, he does not envisage becoming the latest player to sign a short-term deal with a European club while the MLS is on break. The former Ivory Coast captain scored an impressive 12 goals in 14 appearances for Montreal. And acting FIFA president Issa Hayatou is continuing in his post despite undergoing a kidney transplant. A statement from the World Soccer's governing body on Friday said Hayatou has long suffered from a renal insufficiency. He said, however, that the situation has not prevented him from fully performing his duties as the world and African football governing bodies without interruption. He will continue to fulfill his role as acting FIFA president as intended, FIFA says. The 69-year-old Cameroonian, who is also the head of the Confederation of African Football, has been running FIFA since Sepp Blatter was suspended for 90 days last month. Ironically, Blatter too has been undergoing medical treatment for stress. The 79-year-old was in hospital for several days with a condition that was not considered serious. He was discharged on Wednesday. In other news, the German national soccer team was back home on Saturday after spending Friday night at the Stade de France because of the terror attacks in Paris that left over 100 people dead. The World Cup winners had been due to return to their hotel after playing the friendly game against France, but stayed inside the stadium after two explosions went off outside during the game. Germany is due to play the Netherlands in Hanover on Tuesday, but has delayed its journey. All team activities scheduled for today, Sunday, have been cancelled. Meanwhile, as France grappled with the aftermath of another terrorist attack, organizers of the European Soccer Championship faced renewed concerns about how to protect fans attending 51 matches in 10 stadiums around the country next year. Friday night's deadly bloodshed started when two explosions went off outside Stade de France during the national team's match against Germany. The same stadium will host the tournament's opening game on June 10th and the final 1 month later. The European tournament is held every 4 years. It is second in global prestige only to the World Cup. With 24 teams involved across 10 venues, the risks are enormous and the fans severely exposed to danger inside and outside stadiums. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Shegun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now, sending it back to Peter Klote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Shegun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sports Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect a flashback with music from the continent to enjoy.
dance it like she did fight to karate. Hey, I bought in a Bugatti. Hey, I go buy you Ferrari. You don't get any choice but to marry. Hey, I go give you the khaki. Hey, you be calling me daddy. Hey,
for to laugh, I mean Sissy the Gule. Hey, for to be, come on me, the Gule. Hey, your body bad, don't see Sissy the Gule. Hey, the Gule. Hey, how to see the.
Ooh, she the Chris, when she give me the low waist.
Let you go, yeah.
Our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa. Here are the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
The barbaric terrorist coordinated attacks in Paris, the capital of France, which resulted in the deaths of over 127 persons and hundreds of wounded, with 99 critically wounded, reminds us that terrorism is a global phenomenon and should be tackled globally. The international community has only one international security organization which every member state accepts. That is the Security Council of the United Nations, and the global fight against terrorism should be concentrated in that institution, even though it is still unreformed. The last few weeks have been very terrible for terrorism. Just few weeks ago, a Russian plane flying from the tourist venue of Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt and flying to St. Petersburg in Russia crashed in the Sinai with no survival. This has been attributed to an act of terrorism, even though the investigation is continuing. Just a few days ago, in Beirut, Lebanon, an area of the capital that is populated by Shiites and under the influence of Hezbollah, also came under a terrible terrorist act with many, many casualties. As of now, the international community does not have a consensus on the motivation of terrorist actions. There have been varying interpretations and reasons given. But what we do know is that terrorism has no geographical boundary. Africa, in particular, continues to be the victim of terrorism. For some time now, Egypt has been fighting terrorism in the Sinai. Kenya has been a victim of many terrorist acts perpetrated by Al-Shabaab. So is Somalia, which has also come under many Al-Shabaab terrorist acts. And therefore, we have to take some notice that Africa has to be focused on. In Nigeria, in Niger, and other countries surrounding Nigeria are in constant attack from terrorists. Boko Haram is everywhere. And we should also take into account that Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab are affiliates of international terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS or Daesh. I say this because it is not worthwhile to focus only on the industrialized countries when there are terrorist acts. We do send our condolences to the French people and the French government. But do not forget about the innocent Nigerian who will be in the marketplace shopping and then attacked by suicide bomber, or a Nigerian waiting for in a bus stop to be transported and yet attacked by a suicide bomber. So this is why the global approach is vital and essential. This does not mean that it could not be discussed within the group of 20, which will be meeting, but the Security Council must assume its responsibility that terrorism is a global phenomenon, and unless attacked globally, we are going to have a constant attack from terrorist groups. Intelligence group and security forces can do all they can to limit terrorism, but the terrorists only need one chance, and that's what we saw in the coordinated attack in Paris last Friday. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Segun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Greg Burns, we say thanks for joining us. I remember us and the elders say, before you ridicule the baboon of its age and posture, try to count the number of hunter's arrows it has dodged or survived. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The ambassadors of the United States of America, the Netherlands, Norway, Finland, Sweden, Germany, and Denmark, along with the High Commissioners for the United Kingdom and Canada, in a joint statement issued on November 4th, once again underscored their strong and ongoing support for a vibrant, free, and independent civil society in Kenya. In this context, the statement read, "We welcome the decision by the government of Kenya to suspend the Non-Governmental Organizations Coordination Board's October 29th notice that it intends to cancel the registration certificates of 959 Kenyan NGOs. The original decision announced by the board raised serious concerns and questions about regulation of the sector." The signatories noted that, "As international partners, we are fully committed to supporting appropriate transparency and accountability with regard to NGOs. However, we also believe that regulation must be fair, reasonable, and justly administered. We urge the board to ensure all NGOs have timely information and an adequate opportunity to answer any questions or address concerns. We, as donors, require detailed financial reports and regular audits from NGOs that we partner with, and insist on transparency and accountability in our ongoing oversight. We have no evidence that NGOs to which we provide donor funds are supporting or funding terrorism or are engaged in other illegal activity." The government signatory to the joint statement strongly support the rights to freedom of expression, peaceful assembly, and association for civil society as is guaranteed in the Constitution of Kenya, and firmly believe that a strong civil society is vital to protecting fundamental rights, strengthening democratic institutions, building prosperity, and ensuring security. NGOs provide a wide range of essential services to Kenyans, including in health care and education. The government's issuing the statement again urged the government of Kenya to implement as soon as possible the Public Benefit Organizations Act of 2013, which provides an excellent framework for the regulation of civil society organizations, while at the same time ensuring transparency and accountability in the sector's work.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.